Hi, I'm Nathan Scott, and thank you so much for tuning in to Sunday Morning. In the studio with me now from the Araminta Freedom Initiative, an organization dedicated to assisting young women who are victims of human trafficking, as well as raising awareness about the issue in general, is Carrie Freshour. She is the Chief Operating Officer, as well as the Interim Executive Director of the initiative. Carrie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Nathan, for having us. We're glad to be here.
So for anyone who's not aware of Araminta Freedom Initiative, can you tell me, first of all, what the organization is and what it does?
Sure, I'm glad to. Araminta Freedom Initiative was founded in 2010. Mm-hmm. It started with eight founders of the organization who came together with a heart for and a calling to address human trafficking, and specifically looking across Maryland to see where are the gaps and how to best serve in this movement. And over the last, I'd say, almost 9 years, mm-hmm. We have really worked to make our mission happen through awakening, equipping, and mobilizing the community at large to respond to this need. We do that through a few key ways, which mm-hmm. is some prevention and intervention strategies, really mobilizing a volunteer movement, getting people not only aware of the issue, but involved in the issue, and providing restorative survivor services.
So human trafficking as an issue is something that I don't think a lot of people are aware is as prevalent as it is. This is something that, as a society, we tend to like to relegate to, you know, centuries past as a problem that was solved long ago, without realizing that not only is this a problem in the nation in general, but as you mentioned, specifically in the state of Maryland. Can you tell me a little bit about what human trafficking looks like in the 21st century?
Certainly. I think it's a big misconception that if trafficking is occurring here in the United States, it's by foreign nationals being mm-hmm. brought here to the United States and trafficked for labor or sex trade. And what the reality here in the United States, and specifically in Maryland, is that the vast majority of trafficking that's occurring today is U.S.-born citizens. Hmm. And so long from the days of the slave trade, we have a lot of connection here in Maryland through the Underground Railroad mm-hmm. And the trafficking and the slave trade. What we see today is that that's still occurring. And in fact, some reports will say that there are more slaves today than there were back in the days of slavery. Mm-hmm. What that looks like is often people don't understand that we didn't maybe always call it trafficking. And so in the recent years, we've begun to really change our laws and really recognize what that looks like here in the United States. Araminta, we focus primarily on child sex trafficking, so mm-hmm. domestic sex trafficking of children or minors here in Maryland.
And even the name of the organization, Araminta, is building on the legacy of people who have fought human trafficking throughout Maryland history. Can you tell me a little bit about the name Araminta, where it comes from?
Absolutely. So many people are familiar, especially here in Maryland, with Harriet Tubman. Mm-hmm. And what people often don't know is that Harriet Tubman's given name was Araminta, and Araminta means defender. So at Araminta, what we really try is to aim and walk in her footsteps, like other abolitionists like Frederick Douglass and William Wilberforce, to bring freedom to this generation and end modern-day slavery right here in the United States and specifically in Maryland.
So talking about modern-day slavery, this is something where, you know, knowing the statistics of exactly how large the problem is going to be very important in figuring out the ways to best address it. What can you tell me about the numbers involved with the issue of human trafficking?
Yeah, so one of our partners that we work closely with is Shared Hope International, and in mm-hmm. their recent reports, they say that on any given day, there's over 100,000 children that are at risk of trafficking here in Maryland, and there are a lot of different risk factors that we look for to identify what that looks like here. Between 2013 and 2018 here in Maryland, there have been over 500 reports of suspected child sex trafficking that were screened into our Maryland's 24 local Department of Social Services agencies. What that means is it involved over 400 individual alleged minor victims. Mm-hmm. Before 2012, this wasn't even considered an issue of child abuse. So in 2012, legislation passed that really changed the family law definition to include child sex trafficking, human trafficking in the definition of child abuse. When that happens, what that means is that mandated reporters are now mandated to report those things. So youth serving professionals, school counselors, school professionals, you know, medical providers are all now required and mandated to report any concerns of human trafficking, specifically child sex trafficking to a minor, labor trafficking. And what that did was really change our language from a criminal perspective to a preventative and protective perspective, making that so that we have to now see those children as victims and not as criminals.
And that makes a big difference. I mean, semantics in just casual conversation, it may not sound like it's that big of a deal, but from a legal perspective, this drastically changes not just the way that the children are protected, but also the way that human traffickers, when they are caught, are prosecuted, and the sorts of sentences that they can receive for what is, you know, in all cases, a horrific act. What do you think it is about the issue that makes people either turn a blind eye to it or just, you know, become sort of blissfully unaware that this is even a problem?
Sure. It's a good question. I think a lot of the biggest barrier right off the bat is that it's such a dark issue. No one likes to talk about or think about this happening. I think the next thing that you often see is, well, it's not happening here in my neighborhood. It's maybe happening in this bad neighborhood over here. And so that really makes people feel like it might be an issue and they have, you know, a heart for how horrific that crime is, but do not have a reality of that being in their own community.
Right. What was your entry point into this sort of work? What drew you to the issue of human trafficking and wanting to combat it as not just something that you care about in intellectual sense, but something that you work towards defeating every day?
Great question. Thanks for asking, Nathan. I became really aware of the issue probably back in around 2008. I was working on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon for a child advocacy center. Here in Maryland, we have child advocacy centers as well. In fact, we just passed legislation that is mandating that every county have a child advocacy center, which is a place where children go when there's concerns of child maltreatment and trauma, a place where they get forensic interviews in a way where people are coming together, such as law enforcement, child protective services, social workers, therapists, coming together to really protect that child, understanding trauma and knowing that telling your story once is hard enough. So hopefully being at a center like that allows them to only tell their story once. And for the multidisciplinary team to be able to respond. So I spent several years working in that environment. And what we started seeing in Portland at that time was that there were so many kids that were coming in by law enforcement who had been arrested for prostitution, yet they were minors. And no one really knew what to do with them. No one knew what that was called exactly. It was kind of like, how do we respond? And then those children oftentimes would run away from any protective system that they were placed in to try to get them involved. So that was really my first look at, you know, having a strong background in child maltreatment and working within that field of being unsure of what this was and why didn't we have laws to protect it and why are these, you know, 14, 15 year old kids coming in and being treated as criminals. So that really just laid that on my heart. And then a few years later, found myself relocating to Maryland and just networking and connecting with services just like that. And that's how I found Araminta, and the rest is history.
Since you've become interim executive director in the past year, has your perspective on how you address the problem changed at all, or has it made you aware of other issues to be dealt with?
Yes to both. I would say that the one thing that I love about how Araminta addresses this issue is that it's a community response. It's not about us as staff. It's not about the board. It's about all of us collectively, the volunteers we train, the community at large, other partners of victim services, and really coming together and not working against each other, but working collaboratively to address the issue. At Araminta, we say that trafficking occurs because community and family, there's been a breakdown in that system. And what we try to aim and address that through is a restorative community response, that it isn't just one of us, it's all of us, and helping people to not only be aware of the issue, but be mobilized to actually do something. I think that has been just something that has really made a difference and allowed us to do the work we've done. To your second question.
Just essentially, are there any larger issues that you've become aware of in your time as interim executive director?
Thank you for that. I think one of the issues that we collectively see at Araminta and through the partners that we work with is that housing is a really big need. And placement for these minors that are involved in trafficking. We've got systems in place for kids that have experienced trauma. When you talk about child sex trafficking, the trauma is so complex. You think about the multiple points where they are experiencing trauma over and over again. And our systems are lacking the specialized training to be able to respond to what the complex trauma looks like day to day from a survivor.
Right.
So we really work collectively, you know, and collaboratively to start addressing those things. Housing becomes one of those things that Araminta is still constantly discerning. How do we make a difference in that area?
Right.
I think as a community and as a movement, we're looking at those same things. Runaways is the one of the top risk factors for trafficking occurring with adolescent runaways. And so how do we begin to address what they're running from or why they're running, and how do we get them into a place where they can feel safe? Trust is such a big issue that's been broken. So how do we wrap around them from the beginning to make them feel safe so that we can begin to really unpack some of the trauma that they've lived through?
And this is a difficult topic, but an important one. If you're just tuning in, my name is Nathan Scott. You're listening to Sunday Morning, and I'm speaking with Carrie Freshour of the Araminta Freedom Initiative. She's the Chief Operating Officer, as well as the Interim Executive Director. Araminta Freedom Initiative is an organization that assists young women who have been the victims of human trafficking, as well as raising awareness about the issue in general. Carrie, you spoke just a little while ago about how people tend to assume that this is a problem that's taking place someplace else, or that it's in the bad part of town, that, you know, not in my neighborhood. But, you know, you mentioned that you can't always assume that that's the case. Just because you're not in the bad part of town doesn't mean that this is something that's not going on in your neighborhood. If you can't rely on indicators such as the bad part of town to help you figure out where human trafficking might be going on, what are some of the signs and things that you can look for to be able to recognize it and begin to address it?
Sure. Yes, it's true. Child trafficking is happening all over Maryland. And some of the key indicators that we look for is certainly, as I mentioned, runaways is one of the top risk factors. What that means for us when we're looking at risk factors specifically for trafficking is a chronic runaway. And what that means is somebody that's run away three or more times or for 30 days or more at one time. And so we look for educating our teachers and our school staff who know kids are truant or, you know, not coming to school. We also know that about 93% of survivors that we are speaking to and that are willing to share their story report that they've been abused, sexually abused as a child. So you think about the context of somebody exploiting them at such a young age, that becomes all that they know. So to them, they're not knowing that they're being trafficked. They may not even know that they're being abused, because that's what has come into their world at a young age.
It's just what they know is normal.
Absolutely. Some of the other risk factors include children that are involved in our systems, such as the juvenile justice system or child welfare, being placed in multiple foster care homes or group homes, and lots of movement within becomes a really great risk factor, because if they already don't feel connected and maybe they've already been exploited at a younger age through something like child sexual abuse or other forms of maltreatment, and somebody comes along and helps them to feel like, hey, I'm going to make life different, I'm going to sell you the dream. It's really easy when kids are vulnerable like that to believe someone's going to help them get out of that. So those are two of the top indicators that we see a lot. You've also got drug and alcohol issues. A lot of times traffickers are using drugs and alcohol in order to manipulate their victims. And gang involvement is another one that we see a lot here in Maryland.
And so all of these things are, you know, building up to the trust issues that you mentioned earlier, which is that when you've had someone win your trust and then betray it so many times, I would imagine it makes the work of an organization like Araminta somewhat difficult. Here you are coming in and, you know, genuinely wanting to pull them out of this scenario, but they've already, you know, they've had this dream so many times and seen it dashed before. What are some of the ways that you combat that natural inclination to mistrust people who are wanting to help them?
I think the very first thing is that we have to address trust first. So when we're mobilizing volunteers, for example, in our mentor program, we're really taking the time up front to train and educate them, not only on the issues of trafficking, but on what that trauma looks like in a day-to-day relationship, and really equipping them to just begin being there, show up, say, you know, what you say you're going to do, do that. And so time and time again, when people have lied or misled these young women and children, they're not coming in with that trust of us. So the way we build that is through relationship, through continuing to show up. And we go through a phase of engagement in our mentoring program where we're equipping those volunteers to do just that. And then really progressing as the survivor is ready to progress.
Right.
And that may be short-lived, that may be long-term, and we're in it for the long game of that. They may leave and come back, those survivors, and we're there to welcome them every time. So that is the biggest factor that I see in really showing that not all people exploit. Not all people are going to lie to you for their own personal and financial gain.
And so what are some of the tools and services that you offer to both volunteers who come to work with Araminta specifically, as well as the communities that they serve in? How do you prepare people for working with a victim of that sort of trauma?
Great question. We start with a community response of training. So if somebody is interested in getting involved or even just learning more about what the issues are, we offer a Awaken community awareness training, which is really just giving them kind of the high level, what is trafficking and how does it occur and what are some local statistics here. And from that, often people are awakened and want to do more. And we have a 2-day training where we train volunteers to be equipped, to understand. And then we look to where their skills are. How can we engage them? We believe that everybody has a place in this movement. And so finding the skills and ways that they can engage, whether that be, you know, that they're a teacher and they want to provide tutoring to this student who has missed 30, 60 days of school and is behind, coming in and meeting them there. Or whether that be just helping them to get from point A to point B, bringing backpacks full of basic need items to them when they're first placed in a foster care or diagnostic center for treatment. It also really looks like if somebody's interested in working directly with a survivor, there's an additional 12 hours of training that we provide free of charge for our volunteers to really start to understand and unpack the trauma components of responding to trafficking.
And, you know, this is, again, all vital information that people need to have before working with someone who's been through this trauma, just so that way you can start on as even of a playing field as possible to make the most progress the fastest. Though for people who may not want to commit all that amount of time, it is a large commitment. It takes a special sort of person to do this sort of work. There are other ways to get involved. You recently had a 5K as well as a 10K called Race Against Traffic. That was a little earlier this month on Saturday the 11th, raising money to assist in the mission of Araminta Freedom Initiative. Can you tell me a little bit about how the race went and what the money collected is going to go towards?
Yes. So each year we do the Race Against Traffic. It is our largest fundraiser, but it's so much more than that. It's an opportunity of unity within the community, awakening and spreading that awareness much larger than, just our internal programming, really helping people to understand that this is something that we all can be a part of. This year's race, we had just under 700 participants, and we are 95% to our goal. So we had a goal of raising $80,000. And we are just close to crossing the finish line with that.
All right.
So that's always a way that people can get involved, whether that be to walk or run or just bring their children out to the Family Fun Center. It's a beautiful day of community. And it's really the perfect picture of what Araminta is all about. Like I had said earlier, it's not about just one of us. It's about all of us. Mm-hmm. And we believe that to our core, and our mission is grounded in that community building. So it's a beautiful day to see everyone come together for those, just the variety of ways that they come to us at that race. I think some of the other ways, there's multiple ways volunteers can get mm-hmm. involved with our organization, whether that be through tangible needs where they say, I want to be on your listserv. So if you have a survivor that has a need like a new crib for their baby, or maybe they need back to school clothes or an outfit to go to an interview in, that we can reach out to. We have over 250 volunteers that are just on that list mm-hmm. that monthly get that email, and then they respond. I can provide a gift card. I can provide that crib. So that's one easy way right. that people can get involved. Some people get involved and they want to help operations. We take all of their help and we're excited to have them. And so we have volunteers that come weekly into our office mm-hmm. to help with planning for the race or to help with putting packets together and information and education tools, right. things like that.
And by the way, that race does already have a date for next year, May 9th, 2020. If you want to put it on your calendars now, it's a great way to kick off what, given that it's Maryland, I would assume will be the start of spring weather, though you never really know.
Yes.
I would like to ask real quick about a partnership that you recently entered into with the Maryland Department of Education, along with local school systems. It's to help increase awareness of human trafficking prevention, as well as how to intervene in those sorts of situations. What did you learn during the initial phases of piloting that program, and how are you going to incorporate that into its continuing operation?
Thanks for asking. Over the last several years, we've really begun partnering with the Maryland mm-hmm. Department of Education to look at the needs of trafficking and try to figure out how do we address that in school systems.
Right.
In Maryland, we've got a variety of sizes of school systems. So here in Central Maryland, you know, we have three really large school systems to look at. But on the Eastern mm-hmm. Shore, they're smaller systems. So how do we look at infusing this training and education to educators who really and oftentimes are the first responders? I think one of the misconceptions is if kids are involved in trafficking, they're not coming to school, and that's just not true. They may not be coming routinely. They may have gaps in their attendance, but they show up. Because this is such a criminal industry, mm-hmm. you know, I think what we've seen is that traffickers have gotten smart to, well, if the child isn't at school, there are more questions are going to be asked. So if they come to school at least sometimes, maybe they'll fly under that radar.
Right.
So what we learned is that we needed to really have a three-prong approach. We needed to address training and education at the central office level, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Looking at policy. Many of our school systems still hadn't updated their child abuse policies to reflect the 2012 change in legislation, including trafficking as a form of child abuse. So we started by looking at those systems and how can mm-hmm. we help influence that policy to be a protective policy and something that will be utilized across the board for all educators, for all school staff, cafeteria, kitchen, janitors, office staff, all mm-hmm. need to understand because they hear kids talking in
right.
the halls and wherever they might be. So we want to be able to look at the policy first.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the second phase of that is really finding key staff, school counselors, social workers, PPWs, which are pupil personnel workers that go mm-hmm. out into the community when kids are truant and missing, and really going and training them intensively for a full day to understand not just the 101 of trafficking, but getting deep into how they can respond. And then the third phase included going to all of the schools that we were working with.
Mm-hmm.
We had 10 schools in each school system. There were three school systems we worked with. And we trained the entire staff on who are the people now in your building that are your go-to experts in, that mm-hmm. we've trained, and how do you recognize and how do you respond? That included helping them understand how do they make a report to Child Protective Services? How do I talk about the concerns and the risk factors in a way that's going to be heard and understood as a suspected child sex trafficking case?
Even though you've only been interim executive director for just about a year now, you've been working on this issue for over a decade. In that time, what are some of the ways that it's most impacted you or changed the way that you live your life?
Me personally, I think it's just really having a deeper and richer understanding of the difficulties after that trauma, of how to just pick up and rebuild your life. I think sometimes there's this misconception of we've saved you, or we've recovered you, and now everything's going to be great. And that's just not a reality. Oftentimes our FBI partners say that on average, when you identify a victim of trafficking 5 to 7 more times, they will go back to that life. So understanding that we must not give up, that we have to welcome them back. At Araminta, we take young women and children into our services up to the age of 22. But after that, we don't stop those services. If they stop services or engagement with our organization after a time, we then are there when they come back. I think that is so critical, because we have so many other systems that are maybe governed by insurance or billing, and you can, you know, if someone doesn't show up 3 times, you no longer can see them.
Right.
We are eliminating barriers. We're learning more and more from survivors who are informing our programs, and we're always listening to them to help educate us, because they know best.
So this is important work that you're doing. If anyone would like to get contact, get involved, whether that's volunteering or financially, anything like that, what are some of the best ways to do so?
They can go to our website at aramentafreedom.org. They can also email us at contact@aramentafreedom.org. And I just thank you for your time today, and look forward to the community joining us in this mission.
All right. Well, Carrie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
My name is Nathan Scott. I've been speaking with Carrie Freshour, the Interim Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of Araminta Freedom Initiative. Again, their website is aramintafreedom.org. Please give it a look. It's got some important information on what they're doing now and what they hope to do in the future. I'm Nathan Scott, and we'll be back in just a bit.